Hello and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the smart pop culture talk show. Every week we put music, telly, film and the whole world of entertainment on the dissection table and we rummage through its innards to find out what keeps it moving. This week our two special guests are Hannah Verdier, TV and music writer for The Guardian, eonline.co.uk and, back in the good old days, Smash Hits magazine. Hannah is an unapologetic advocate of soaps as TV's highest achievement. Back in the heady days of Just 17 and Smash Hits, she went round to Tony Blair's house and to John Bon Jovi's too. She was also the launch editor of Pop World Pulp, a magazine that The Media Guardian called the biggest failure in recent times. It lasted two entire issues. Hello, Hannah. How are you?
Wow, what glittering career. Hello, everyone.
I think it's always good to have. You've got to have at least one magnificent failure in your CV, haven't you? God knows we have.
That's my speciality.
Yeah, we may actually be listening to it right now. What was Tony Blair's, what was Tony Blair's toilet like? Did you go to Tony Blair's toilet or nose around his house at all?
Yeah, went round Downing Street, actually. And yeah, it was a beautiful thing. Alistair Campbell was really nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a beautiful day.
Who was that for?
It was for Just 17.
Oh, amazing. Just getting the teenage vote there for
yeah.
Bright young Blair.
Yeah,
beautiful.
I think I asked him about
teenagers
tampon
who can't actually vote.
Yes. I took a 13-year-old with me for protection.
Excellent.
So I could ask those tricky questions.
Splendid. Okay, it's very much TV week here on Big Mouth because also with us is Michael Hogan, TV writer for The Telegraph and, back in the good old days, editor of Sky magazine, which sought to work out once and for all who's the hottest, Louise from Eternal or Martine McCutcheon?
Louise from Eternal is the answer.
Correct. Michael was a very early adopter of the Howard Jones fan club. He was member number 39. And as a child, he was once reduced to tears by Windsor Davis from It Ain't Half Hot Mum. Michael, hello. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
How did Windsor Davis reduce you to tears?
Don't worry, it's not an Operation Yew Tree.
he's dead, he's totally like.
Okay. I went to see Windsor Davis and Donna Estelle at Felixstowe Pier Pavilion around the time of Whispering Grass with my mum. I was very small. And I had bright red ginger curly hair.
Ah.
I know this, don't worry, this gets somewhere. Windsor Davis walks down the aisle in Sergeant Major mode and the spotlight danced down the aisles and lit up my hair like a halo, like a ginger halo.
Wow.
Windsor Davis squinted at me and said, "What's that you've got on your head, lovely boy?" And I was 4 years old and I started crying uncontrollably and my mum had to take me out and take me home.
Oh, good Lord. Well, we promise not to reduce you to tears today. We hope. We'll do our best not to do that.
Donna Estelle, however, was lovely.
Well, was it about the same height as you if you're 4 years old? Also with us, as ever, our combination of key grip, rostrum camera and best boy, it's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
Thanks for not calling me a fluffer.
Not a fluffer. Not yet. We haven't quite descended to that level yet. A little bit later, we'll be talking about what the discerning viewer ought to be seeking out on TV. But first, just briefly, many of us were shocked this week to see footage of a record shop in Istanbul being invaded by violent protesters during a playback event for Radiohead's new album, A Moon-Shaped Pool. A mob of about 20 people forced their way into Velvet Indie Ground, which is the name of the shop, and attacked people who were inside listening to the new album. We're going to discuss that in a minute, but first, here's a track from that album. Here is True Love Waits. That was Radiohead with True Love Waits from A Moon-Shaped Pool. Last week, a listening party in Istanbul was wrecked by what appeared to be a group of Islamic conservatives. The band have condemned the attack. They said, "We hope that someday we'll be able to look back on such acts of violent intolerance as things of the ancient past. For now, we can only offer our fans in Istanbul our love and support." People have claimed that the attack happened because people in the shop were drinking during Ramadan, but it seems pretty clear as well that it was an attack on the idea of Western music and Western culture in an increasingly conservative country. Michael, have we ever seen anything like this happen before? People attacking music in this way, do you think?
I've certainly felt like attacking people listening to Radiohead.
But not for their political affiliations because they get on your nerves.
Yeah, but it's a fairly new phenomenon to me and quite a disturbing one. I think Turkey's I get the impression it's in a strange place right now.
Yeah,
because the world's a dark place as well at the moment.
Yeah.
We need a large rock festival to come full of peace and love to sort everything out, I think.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, is Istanbul the right place to do a large peace and love rock festival?
Probably not. No.
Well, but there was the following night, there was a protest against the attack where about 20 times as many people turned up to support the record shop and have a massive tear gas riot kickoff, which Turkey does very, very well. I mean, are we just thinking, Hannah, do you think possibly, by focusing on this attack, we are imagining that Turkey is a country that's full of people like that, whereas in fact it's full of people probably like ourselves?
It's certainly, well, certainly very volatile, but it is the clash of the two cultures, isn't it? Some might argue that it's quite a brave move to have a listening party during Ramadan and crack open the beers. But when these sort of things happen, like when the Eagles of Death Metal shootings happened, it's really hard because we're in music, I think, we're going to gigs and you feel like it's a form of escapism, you're away from it all, but suddenly it's in, like, our space.
Yeah.
And it's so hard because you start to identify with it, which, of course, you should. But you just think with the festival season coming up, who's safe? How safe can we be? It's really hard to police, I think.
Yeah, you tend to think that you're insulated and you're in your kind of, you know, a fully kind of westernised liberal world where nothing can really touch you.
And I guess Orlando was very much an example of that, wasn't it? But then the sort of the post-Orlando tribute vigils were much like this one in that they kind of restored your faith and everything. They were massively attended and kind of lovely things to see.
Yeah. To me, the irony is that, you know, if you were to choose any band to epitomise Western rock and roll decadence, Radiohead would be the very last thing, wouldn't they? I mean, it's so far from that ideal.
But it's kind of like those that situation which, you know, legend has it that you had kind of when the Iron Curtain was up. It's kind of interesting that the bands that get taken as a symbol of kind of Western freedom and kind of and all the connotation that kind of comes with that. So that, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, you had kind of like some kind of rather strange bands being kind of picked up as kind of icon beacons of Western kind of democracy.
The Hoff,
and stuff.
The Hoff, mainly.
you know. And it just, you're right. I think Radiohead is quite an interesting one.
It's, well, they are the modern Pink Floyd, and I suppose they kind of express that idea that you can wander off into your own private headspace. And if the kind of people who are looking to politicise society from top to bottom, where everything has to serve a particular political ideal, where everything has to be, you know, fundamentally pointing in the right kind of quasi-nationalist direction, it is a threat to them if people can wander off and live in their own heads and form their own opinions. Do we think Radiohead should go and play a big gig in Istanbul?
No, they've suffered enough.
No, well, for Radiohead fans.
I think they should, as long as they draw the line at anything post the bends, because let's face it, they haven't put anything good out since then.
Oh, that's just not true.
Play the tunes.
Right. Seriously.
Play some old.
Play some old. I can see it's very hard to get through the wall of intransigence, but it's... those Roundhouse shows lately, they were absolutely fantastic, you know, exciting stuff. Okay, moving on, but sticking with music. This week sees the release of The Bride, the fourth album by the avant-garde singer-instrumentalist Natasha Khan, also known as Bat for Lashes. The Bride is an actual for-real concept album concerning a woman whose husband-to-be is killed in a car crash on the way to their church wedding. It deals with death, the aftermath, the grief, and with finding yourself a widow without ever having been married in the first place. We'll talk about it in a minute, but first, here's a sample track. This is Bat for Lashes with In God's House. And In God's House from the new album The Bride. Yes, we've started with old bangers this week. It's all hands in the air and lighters aloft. Hannah, this is an unusual subject for an entire album, isn't it? A woman left alone because her fiancé dies on the way to the church. We've never heard this before, have we?
Well, I don't know why not, because it's what a great concept.
It's almost,
what can one say?
It's almost a Reveal magazine cover line, isn't it? I can't marry you because I'm dead.
I think it might be a Kerikatona special. On the surface, it's about that. But actually, I wonder if it's about the fact that there is no husband at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I read an interview with her where she's saying, I'm 36 now and I'm on my own. I didn't go for an arranged marriage. And can women be like that? Because also in Sex in the City, even the single ones end up married.
Yeah.
So is it about the death of marriage and about the fact that you have to love yourself, as Justin Bieber would say, quite rightly.
Yeah. Well, she does certainly kind of paints the husband as a sort of semi-mythical, distant, nearly imaginary figure, doesn't she?
Yeah. And if there's a... I think in one of them, it's like he didn't turn up because he's dead, but key point is he didn't turn up. He could have made the effort.
We've all used that excuse on dates.
I really hope this isn't autobiographical.
In marriage.
what did you make of it as a record? Dead. As a listener, what did you make of it as a listener?
As a listener, as the whole piece, I find it quite hard going. Mm. It's not for me. I'm a disco fan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear about a dead husband problems. No, but
empathy
actually,
there. Yeah, I don't really have a dead husband problem.
It's not real, is it?
Shape up, girlfriend.
Get on those heels and get out there.
Get out of the
hand. You okay, hun?
Yeah.
No, I mean, there was some good slight semi-electro disco bangers like Sunday Love I quite liked. And I think it would be the kind of album that you should see performed live as well when she does the whole wedding and she's in her red dress and she's...
Yeah.
Taking the full concept as a show rather than sitting there on a rainy Tuesday afternoon.
She is enormously theatrical, isn't she?
Yeah, well, and I really love performers who are like that.
Mm.
And I think quite a lot of it, it's where you should be watching the video as well. You can't just listen to it. But I think it's really hard these days to listen to a whole album, especially if it's about being jilted by a dead bloke. Because you do,
she should have called it that, jilted by a dead bloke.
But I think you do become immersed in it, which is what she wants.
Yeah. Michael, what did you make of it? As a heartless man with a heart of stone.
I preferred it. I liked it more than Hannah did, actually. I quite liked it. I'm a big Kate Bush fan, and obviously she gets compared to her all the time, and it is very Kate Bushian times, and it's very Sinead O'Connor, and... You know, there's a lot of metaphors to unpick and stuff. It's not something you put on for a barrel of Lowell's and the kitchen disco on a Friday night, but it's,
But I quite like the fact that you do have to listen to this as a full album. We spend so much time just putting the iPhone on shuffle and listening to a whole lot of things that jar, which can be great, can be very exciting, but to actually take that make a bit of a still moment in your day and listen to something that's not trying to reach out and entertain you, that's trying to dig into something. Okay, we haven't experienced it, but we've all experienced some kind of horrible sideways shock in life.
I think it is very absorbing. You do find yourself kind of, drifting off and being compelled by it. It's kind of got a vibe of sort of trip-hop about it at times. It feels a bit like 90s dinner party music, I think.
Yeah. Well, you said earlier that we haven't heard anything like it before. I kind of disagree with that because there's that track, I think it's Honeymooning Alone, that starts with the sound of a car crashing.
Oh, right. Yes,
and, and it immediately made me think of Leader of the Pack and those kind of death
discs.
Kind of it does have that slightly, because it's a female vocalist and a lot of those work traditionally sung by women, it does have that Joe Meek 60s kind of vibe, and I think that trip-hop thing is part of that as well. It's kind of very drifty. I was really surprised kind of how much I liked it without really listening to it, putting it on and letting it kind of play through. Yeah.
So there's some lovely little bits of harpsichord on it, though, that made me put me in mind of Bagpuss as well, which is never a bad thing.
Unfortunately, the mice didn't come out saying, we can make him.
Dragging poor dead husband out of the crashed toy
sequel.
Car.
Yeah. Well, I think it is. Isn't it supposed to be like a soundtrack to a film that hasn't been written, all that kind of stuff? So she's talked about turning it into a film and maybe a book and stuff. It does seem to be a proper body of work. Yeah, I don't think she needs to worry. She might be 36, but she's still fit
as. She's in pretty good nick.
Would you, Michael?
Come on.
I would its artist.
But also, I think she's also immensely talented, and how is she still on the sidelines where Florence has... blown up, as the young people say.
Florence has kind of gotten the pop roots. Florence has designed pop hits, and there was a time when her doing You Got the Love was utterly inescapable.
Yeah.
And Bat, did we call her Bat? Miss Bat?
Natasha?
Miss Lashes. Hasn't really gone for... I mean, she's best known for the amazing Laura, which is a brilliant, absolute showstopper ballad. And she, as you mentioned, she does have, facility with disco bangers. She could do it, but I sort of think she doesn't want to play. She doesn't want to play that game.
She's won. She has won like Ivor Novello awards for songwriting and stuff. But I think Andrew's right. I don't think an artist has to become as popular as they're physically able. I think she kind of enjoys the ability to go off and make a slightly mad record called Sex Witch with a band toy.
That's Sex Witch as in a magician, not as in a sex sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sex Witch with a T. Yes.
Which is better.
Would you like Branson Pickle on your Sex Witch? Yes.
Yeah. But, that having that kind of freedom to be able to do that, I think is probably quite important to her.
Mm.
Yeah.
Whereas, I guess Florence could have done it, but it would have been a bit of a a different thing.
Well, there's a lot riding on Florence, isn't there? At a record company level, they know that she is a...
Ear protectors, mainly.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, she's not my cup of tea at all.
Natasha needs to shout more to be more successful. Mm.
But I think, you know, with Florence Machine, Mrs. Machine, she's a revenue stream. She's a big deal for her label, and hits are required and big... Yeah.
But she did come from that same, from a similar kind of... When she started out, there was a similar kind of art... vibe around her, and she was kind of hanging out in East London, and she was doing kind of
sort of barefoot art happening.
Yeah, and that's you know,
pictures of walls everywhere.
She can't, you know, that is, she's become that much bigger and more kind of mainstream than that.
Well, you mentioned Kate Bush, and Bat for Lashes is also compared quite often to St. Vincent and Björk and Cat Power and Jonas Policeman, basically women artists. And, is it just because they're women and people go, oh, women in rock, hello, women in rock special? Or, I mean, I suspect actually it's because male artists don't do this kind of thing.
No, I don't think they bear their soul in the same way. They don't dance, you know, in the same way that Kate Bush was trained to do and that Bat for Lashes does.
Yeah.
Bieber does.
Bieber does, but it's not really in the same idiom, is it?
I wouldn't, Kate Bush rarely gets compared to Justin Bieber, does she?
I mean, is there
That's because the women in rock thing. I'm sorry to argue this, but I really... I know you sneer, but I really hate the whole women to look out for. Also, if you work on any kind of media for women, it's always, oh, the music you need to like and the women you know, we're...
Listen to this
record
because it's empowering.
Because a man's told you to.
Yeah. But also, you know, I mean, you were talking about the breakup aspects of this earlier, and off the top of my head, the breakup records that I can think of, and maybe this is just me and my record collection, come from the male point of view, whether it's kind of Costello and Blood and Chocolate or Nick Cave, you know. And they're not particularly pleasant records to listen to. They're quite kind of misogynistic and misanthropic. But it's quite interesting to hear a female, the female kind of point of view of that.
But the artists I just mentioned, they're actually, you know, the Costello thing is about engaging with the real world. It's all entirely plausible. These artists, Björk and St. Vincent and Cat Power, they're off in a mad world of art, aren't they? Which is doesn't seem to be what male artists are doing at all. They're not off in the world of imagination and painting themselves gold and covering themselves in arcane symbols. You know, will we ever get in the near future? Will we get a male equivalent of Bat for Lashes or a male equivalent of Florence Machine?
Well, Father John Misty is a bit like that.
Well, he kind of is, but it's
he tends to wear shoes though rather than dance barefoot across the stage.
The artist formerly known as Anthony and the Johnsons.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah,
What about Kanye West? In his own way, he is in that place.
Yeah, yeah.
In his own way, he is. It's about being an art outrage, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think lots of male artists look at being an art outrage and they think it's a bit effeminate and a bit kind of weedy and probably a bit gay. I think, you know, that is a really difficult thing to get across for a mass selling record. Will we be turned on by Bat for Lashes? Will we be listening to this record again?
I will.
I think I will.
I was surprised and I enjoyed it.
Okay, Bat for Lashes, The Bride is out this week. We've got two seasoned TV journalists with us today, and as we've mentioned before on Big Mouth, the better TV gets, the harder it is to fit the good stuff in. So now that TV is about having your personal favourites, we don't really stumble on things by mistake anymore. It's all based on word of mouth, or it's Walter Presents on Channel 4. So let's play recommendation tennis with our two TV critics. Let's start with Hannah Verdier. I believe one of the shows you want to recommend is Lady Dynamite.
Yes, indeed. It's on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to binge watch because I get really upset when it's all gone in a couple of hours. But this is the thing that I'm closest to binging. So it's the comedian Maria Bamford, and it's what she calls her slightly banana head.
Yeah.
And she's basically losing the plot. And it turns out in real life she has bipolar, so she's really putting her own experiences into it. But stop, it is a comedy. And...
But stop.
Where's it set, and what's the actual?
So it's slightly real life.
Mm-hmm.
She has this amazing agent called Karen, who she will drop a C-bomb. It's quite sweary, but also the way it's shot, I don't think it would really work on TV because the things in the past are shot kind of grainy.
Yeah.
There are flashbacks. There are talking dogs.
Mm.
It's complete madness, but also the one-liners are just hilarious.
It did. I mean, I've not seen the full thing, but watching a clip or two, it does seem to have a bit in common with Kimmy Schmidt, actually, in that it's that kind of mainstreaming of surrealism, of
Definitely.
Having really weird little fantasy sequences and popping into the characters' heads and popping out again.
Yeah, there's one moment where she goes to a dinner party and she puts on a character to pretend that she's really confident, and she has a really has one of those voices, talks about Harvard, and then she meets a man and she can't get away from the voice because he thinks that's her real voice.
Yes.
So she has to keep up the pretense. And her friends are kind of going, everyone does that for the first 6 months of dating, but she still has but it goes too far.
What's her background? What's her own real life story?
So it's not dissimilar to a real life story, but she's been stand up and also she's guested on Arrested Development, and she brings in people like Mira Savino and different guest stars into the show
as well. Sarah Silverman pops up, I think, doesn't she?
I believe so, but I haven't seen that one yet.
Okay. Spoilers. Right.
Is the theme tune Lady Dynamite?
It should be.
If it's not, I refuse to watch it.
Advantage Hogan, what's your go on recommendation tennis?
My favourite thing on TV right now is Silicon Valley, which is probably the most underrated show on HBO. Everyone loves HBO's kind of box set dramas, but sometimes overlooks its comedies. And this is a amazing kind of, it's kind of a satire about a kind of a start, an app startup in Palo Alto, but essentially it's not that geeky and it's a kind of workplace comedy with great characters in it. It's sweary, it's got a brilliant sort of hip hop. A lead soundtrack, and yeah, it's just brilliantly done. It's written and created by Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead, mm-hmm. Office Space fame, King of the Hill, and it has a sort of similarly realistic world that you kind of buy into, and yeah, it's just probably hilarious, and no one seems to watch it.
It's a strange that you'd imagine people would go, why would you make a comedy about startups in California? That's not relatable at all. Nobody understands that well. But then nobody understands propane selling in the middle of Texas, and that King of the Hill worked perfectly well. Yeah. Is it the characters that make it work rather than the dramatic situation?
Yeah, and they tend to be, on the nerdy side, and they tend to be sort of maybe often somewhere on the spectrum, or stoners. But yeah, it's the guys that make it. It's essentially the relationship between the kind of six guys who start up the company. There's a couple of programmers. There's the leader. There's a kind of arrogant, self-aggrandizing investment guy. It's all about the dynamic between them, really. It's like any sitcom. It's kind of, Father Ted in San Francisco.
Right. Okay. Over the net, continuing recommendation tennis. Hannah, tell us about chewing gum, which you're a big fan of.
Yes, this came out last year, but it's one of those I would always turn to if I need a laugh. So Michaela Cole is a good old East London girl, and basically she's reaching her 20s, but she's been quite sheltered, so she's learning about life, learning about sex. And the thing about this is it made me feel absolutely ancient, because it's just seeing how teenagers, well, I think it's how teenagers really talk and what they talk about. And they're so smart. Obviously, it's a... the modern day Dawson's Creek, in as much as it's those sentences are constructed and they're having all the feels, but it's also really, really hilarious. And she started out, I think, with a live show of it, and then it got taken on by Channel 4. And she is just brilliant.
Is it one of those shows where people talk in a suspiciously clever and erudite and witty way, much funnier and cleverer than they are in real life?
Yes, but because they're in London and they're on the state, you don't notice it, which is really bad. But I think that's what always happens with the best kind of teen comedies that grown-ups can enjoy as well.
Yeah.
You don't want to just hear them going, yeah, my day was all right.
Well, it's often, when you tend to see a trailer for a new Channel 4 or an E4 show, being grumpy and old like me, I tend to immediately take against it, because I think I'm just going to be shown a whole load of flashy sort of E4 bumper style.
Kind of like Skins or something. Well, get Skins away from me.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, as if it's going to be, capital Y youth and, very much aimed at a kind of, just trying to like push the wackiness. But this seems to be a lot cleverer than that, with a bit more depth.
I think so, yes. And also, that's your point of view, but I'm always trying to be down with the kids. I can't help it. Like, when is it going to end? I want to know how this movie, I want to know what they're into.
Yeah.
I want to watch them having a Beyonce makeover.
Well, I'm very nearly missed out on Brooklyn Nine-Nine for that reason, thinking it's going to be yet another annoying sort of E4-style show. And actually, it's brilliant. It's pretty much the best American comedy I've seen in ages.
Yeah. It doesn't belong on E4 in some ways, I don't think.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that, another time it would have been like Taxi or something, or even Seinfeld, where it had a massive, a kind of cross ages, cross demographic, shall we say. If you don't know it, it's essentially a cop comedy. It's set in a precinct where they've got a new captain and he's incredibly dull stickler, but hilariously funny with it. But it is the strangeness and the kookiness and the surrealism. It's not really about crimes at all. It's about this odd collection of characters and how they rub up against each other. And it's totally addictive. And it's certainly, it's pretty much the only thing that can get me to watch E4. And yet, for some reason, not available on box set via on demand. I think maybe they've got a rights issue there.
Isn't it on it's on Netflix, isn't it?
Is it on Netflix now?
It's on one of the...
Because it's not on all four anymore.
The problem that I find it a really strange thing, I have a blind spot against watching comedies, half-hour comedies, on demand services. I find it too much hassle to fire up the computer and kind of scroll through and get it all started. Hour-long...
That's so spoiled, I love it.
Hour-long things I've got no problem with. But half hour, it's just, and especially half hours that are actually 24 minutes.
You can watch two in that time.
It's not satisfying. I know it's totally me.
I can understand that though, because it's an hour long drama. You know, when you're settling down with your Walter Presents, or you're settling down with your chin stroking Scandinavian murder show, you feel that you are watching something that you need to pay close attention to, and that it is almost a duty to watch this quality TV from the current golden age of quality TV. With a comedy, you want comedy to be the thing that just washes over you, that you just happen to run into on the schedule and find yourself highly entertained by. And the idea of setting out with the mission of finding an episode of a great comedy, I think Matt's right, actually. I'm not sure I ever do it myself. I mean, I love Archer, for instance, the brilliant animated spy comedy, which is pretty outrageous and ridiculous and very grown up. It's all on Netflix, but I never actually get my finger out to go and, plow through it on Netflix. I just, I'll wait until it jumps out at me.
The way you're conveying this image of you watching Scandinavian dramas and Walter Presents shows for hour-long chin stroke.
Yeah.
You're Kimmy Schmitting up and nine-ninning up.
I'm just watching hours and
you're
hours.
You're watching the E-channel,
I'm actually watching hours and hours of old Doctor Who, as everybody knows.
So Kardashians.
But the question is, how do you find these things? Because there are two things that I'm watching at the moment that I really like. Preacher, which is originally an AMC thing in the States, and which is on Amazon. And Happen Leonard, which likewise is on Amazon, and I think that was on Showcase in the States. The only reason I know those two is because I've actually kind of read the source, the comic in Preacher's case, and the Joe R. Lansdale books about Happen Leonard in the case of the second one. But nobody seems to have picked those up. Nobody seems to be talking about them in this country. They're quite a big thing in the States, I think. But it's kind of a weird one about how you guys, as kind of critics, how do you do that? Do you wait for the kind of press releases? Do you see the kind of talking, do you see the it bubbling on social media? How do you decide?
You can evangelize.
Oh, is it worth kind of taking a couple of hours out and getting
stuck into increasingly,
this?
With a lot of things, you're not so hung up on release dates anymore, or kind of, the first episode, because you can stream everything, you can catch up with everything, you can iPlayer everything. So you kind of want to see if people are watching it, people are talking about it. With Preacher, I've written a couple of pieces about Preacher, but you're right, no one's talking about it over here.
Which is strange, because it's got British actors in it.
Yeah,
it's got the source material is British, although it was published by Vertigo, and it's based obviously in...
Yeah, they're very niche concerns, these things, aren't they?
They're kind of niche, but they're obviously spent a lot of money.
It is a big
budget. It's not a kind of...
No, it's great. It's great.
I think with things... I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Brooklyn Nine-Nine, because that's something that I feel like no one else watches. And for me, it's sort of the Friends effect. It's always on and I always turn to it. And I started watching it because I really like Andy Samberg.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the Commander... can't think of his name in real life.
Andre Breuer, who played Pembleton in Homicide: Life on the Streets.
Yeah, he's kind of sending himself up.
Yeah, he's like the comedy version of Pembleton.
So
he's fantastic.
Brilliant.
Isn't he?
His deadpan delivery, and I think the characterization in that show is spot on, because everyone remains true to the character. There are so many little details. Like one of them's got twins called Cagney and Lacey.
Yeah, that's Terry Crews.
Tiny little things. You know how they're going to react to things, and they all have their foibles. And I just think it's brilliant. And I wonder why it's such a sleeper. Really, I wonder why not everyone's banging on about it.
It's strange, isn't it? So many of these shows on cable, you get or on streaming services, get a disproportionate amount of kind of media attention. You'd think Mad Men was like the biggest show in the world when that was on air, and less than 100,000 people watched it over here.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. And so people always sort of say Netflix, Amazon, they're killing kind of linear TV. And actually, you know, 50 times more people watch linear TV than they do watch streaming services.
Yeah. And 50 times more people will watch a show that nobody really talks about.
Yeah.
It never gets into the media, and yet it's an ITV show or a BBC One show, and it gets a ton of attention.
Well, that's a really interesting point.
Country
made.
File.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't know how many people are watching. They never release the figures. You know, Netflix don't actually say how many people have watched this stuff. Amazon famously don't say how many people have watched their stuff.
Mm. It's the magic of the internet, that is.
It's the magic of the internet, and it's the magic of a really, really good PR organisation. And it's kind of the magic of a media that are kind of a little bit enthralled to stuff that's shiny and new.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, that idea of you know, what's working on streaming and what isn't, brings us to Michael's turn on recommendation 10, is The Living and the Dead, which they've put straight onto box set on
iPlayer. Yeah, that's an interesting thing.
It?
I think that, I'm not sure, that wasn't the decision that was trumpeted much in advance, but yeah, it's a new BBC period sort of horror drama, and it landed as an iPlayer box set last week, the first ever BBC
Michael was doing
drama.
Air quotes there, by the way.
Yes. And they've done this before with comedies like Peter Kay's Car Share and stuff, but they'd never released six episodes of a drama all at once.
Tell us
before.
More about the show.
Well, it's kind of like Poldark with ghosts in it.
Sold.
So it's set in 1894 in Somerset, and Colin Morgan, who's best known for playing Merlin but has grown up a bit now and was in things like The Fall and Humans and is kind of carving out a nice niche for himself as a kind of grown-up actor in quality box set dramas, he plays he's a psychologist, and he comes back to London when his mother dies to kind of inherit the family estate, and then all these terrifying things start happening. It's quite, it's a bit Wicker Man-y. It's got that kind of, because it's set in the countryside, it's got that kind of rural folk horror vibe to it. And something nasty happens with a plough in episode one. No spoilers, but I'm sure you can imagine. Lots of faces appear in mirrors. There are those spooky Victorian dolls that sort of look at you and you think they're about to come to life and kill you.
Is it a documentary?
It's a drama. But it's properly, it's properly scary. And,
it's basically
and chilling.
It's the Archers for Goths, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
It's horror in the countryside.
Yeah, it's sort of a demonic Downton Abbey.
Excellent. Who's behind it? Who are the people behind the show?
Well, it's written by Ashley Farrow, who is best known for writing Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes. So it's his kind of, they were sort of period dramas set in the 70s and 80s, and he's gone back a sort of, you know, another 80-odd years for this one.
Why do you think the BBC have put it out in this manner? But is it a kind of, they're not sure about it? Is that they're testing the water in terms of the, because, or would it have been a thing that they commissioned ages ago and was due to go out on BBC Three and they just don't have the kind of...
It's scheduled on telly too. It starts on Tuesday the 28th at 9 p.m. on BBC One, so it's, you know, got a good slot. I wonder if it's to do with partly with the Euro 2016.
Right.
Telly's getting lost at the moment. No one's watching anything. Everything's getting moved around for football.
Because they did that with the... with the snooker drama, didn't they? They put that out.
Yeah, that was a one-off, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I mean, you kind of... You're right, it does smell a bit of, are they trying to... They're not sure about it. Are they sort of somehow burying it or whatever? But people thought that with Car Share, and that turned out to be one of the biggest, biggest comedy hits in a long time, so...
I really think they're just experimenting.
Yeah, I do.
Though,
I do.
Because we hear so much about streaming and about Netflix, but actually there's so many good 9 p.m. dramas over the last few months on ITV and on BBC. It's just, you know, people are still watching that. And I think we're in a bit of a media bubble if you read all the reviews and all the things that we write, where we think everyone's, you know, everyone's on Amazon, but I don't think in the real world they really are.
Well, the iPlayer dwarfs, you know, Netflix and Amazon.
Absolutely.
It is the most important thing in telly for a lot of people.
Yeah, and you hear so much about linear being dead, but I think particularly in an older audience, when I say older, I mean probably over 35. We're still watching the telly. We still sit down and watch the telly.
Yeah, The Line of Duty, one of the best dramas this year, got I would say about 4 to 5 times more viewers than Game of Thrones in the UK.
Yeah,
but
and
know,
the
which
Manager.
One which one gets more talked about? The Night Manager even more so.
Yeah.
So you know, in this changed world where you know, there are these new things. There is streaming and there is subscription and there's time shifting in ways we never imagined previously. How have your jobs changed? Do you now find that rather than dealing with a straightforward conveyor belt of what you need to watch tonight, do you feel that you need to lead people more to stuff? And does it get frustrating when they flatly refuse to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, for instance?
Yeah, like please, can I just write about Brooklyn Nine-Nine again? I think in my job, because I do quite a lot of previews that still sit along the TV guide, people do still pick up like the Guardian guide every week and plan what they're going to watch, which is a really good thing. But I think also in the online world, we do have to keep up with something the minute. So the minute Lady Dynamite is on, people will be wanting to know about it. Also, I always get
Lady
asked,
Dynamite.
Yeah, like it.
Still trying to get it going, not having it.
And I always get asked to talk about and write things about box sets and binging, because that seems to be everyone thinks that we're just binge watching, and I don't know if we really are.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a bit of a media myth, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right, jobs have changed, and then being a TV guide has got harder, because rather than covering four channels, you're covering, you know, hundreds and streaming services and all sorts of stuff. But I think it just changes the kind of the rhythm of how you write about things. Like I do a lot of like series blogs and episode by episode things now, where rather than kind of reviewing everything the first episode, you kind of things build an audience who want to read about the episode they've just seen. And that's a really satisfying thing to do. It's kind of quite nerdy, and it's quite sort of you get into the sort of nitty gritty detail of it.
Yeah, and it, particularly for things like Game of Thrones and Doctor Who, and you know, and all the murder programs. But I often sort of suspect that some of those things people are reading the blog, so they don't have to watch the show. You know, they're busy lives. You know, wow. Keep up with it.
Well, they'd be fairly baffled though.
But that's a valid use of it. I mean, I got into Game of Thrones late, and I bought the kind of box sets. By the time I think kind of series three was on or whatever, so I went back and got the DVDs, and it was really good to go back. I found myself kind of going back to Sarah Hughes' episode by episode blogs on The Guardian after watching each episode on a DVD, going back to that, and that was kind of like quite a nice way of doing it, of kind of getting slightly more into the whole thing and kind of having different aspects of it opened up.
I've always been a bit like that. I've always preferred reading film reviews after I've seen the film. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of people are like that.
Well, I think particularly
people go too early on stuff all the time.
Yeah. You know?
Particularly with stuff like Game of Thrones, it's so easy to miss very, very significant things. And I was watching this week's Battle of the Bastards.
Yeah.
With no spoilers, this is not a spoiler, but there's a bit where one of the key characters wanders out into a wasteland and starts rummaging through a pile of twigs and holds something in his hand that seems to be incredibly significant. It's a child's toy of a stag or something, and stares at it in a very meaningful way. And then that scene ends and the action moves on. And I've been watching this show since the beginning. I've still no idea what the twig means. What does the twig mean?
Now, we'll talk off air.
Well, yeah, we need to. Yeah, obviously, people are listening to the show and are going, you idiot, remember in season two, episode four, when we were predicted that a twig would save Westeros? Things like that will come through in a blog or a recap that somebody like me, who's semi-watching, half asleep, won't necessarily spot.
Yeah. There was something in I remember. You remember the first series of Broadchurch, which was huge. Then the good series of Broadchurch,
right?
With 10 million people watch, and there was a slug in the first episode. Someone trodden a slug that had no significance whatsoever, but it turned out to be, you know, in episode 10.
The slug was the murderer.
The slug was the signal. The person who stood in the slug was the murderer, because it represented kind of, an alien threat coming into the home.
Ah, right.
And Chris Chibnall kind of buried this little thing just to please himself in it. So maybe it's a bit like that.
Well, I remember in Matt Smith's first season on Doctor Who, or second season, there was a scene where he wasn't wearing a bow tie, and then in the next edit he was wearing a bow tie, or a different jacket, I think it was. And the internet went mad and said, that's terrible, this is awful, you know, poor continuity there. And it turned out that six episodes later, this was massively significant, because it shows there was a timey-wimey thing where you pop back and
wibbly,
pop
forward. Wibbly-wobbly, jackety-wackety.
Yeah, but if even a nerd like me doesn't necessarily spot that, you realise that the blogs and the recaps do have a really important role to play.
Yeah.
Right, that's enough TV. Let's get back to music. This week is, incredibly, the 20th anniversary of the release of Beck's Odelay. And I don't know about you, but that makes me feel really old. It was one of the original examples of rock stars going all in for sampling, and it really transformed Beck's career. Producers, the Dust Brothers, turned his acid folk songs into a full-on sampler-delic wonderland. Before we talk about it, from Odelay, here's The New Pollution. That was The New Pollution by Beck from Odelay. 20 years old this week. Michael Hogan, does that make you feel immensely old?
It does, but it makes me feel kind of immensely young as well. It just listening to it this week made me I could smell kind of CK1 and I could taste hooch and I felt like I was wearing Twisted Levi's.
Is it your Madeleine moment?
Yeah, it's like I got a Proustian rush back to the mid 90s when everything was fun and I was young and didn't have children and a massive box set habit.
Yeah, before box sets even existed. It feels like about 5 minutes ago to me, this. It, you know, 20 years has gone in no time at all. Hannah, were you a fan? Were you a Beck fan?
Do you know what? This is one of my favourite albums. I remember it came out during Euro 96, if I'm not mistaken.
And
I just remember, I remember that time so clearly. I thought it was 10 years ago, actually, 1996. It does.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's only 10 years ago.
For me, yes. No, it was just also, that was a really exciting year because people seem to let the 90s slide a bit music-wise, but Spice Girls Wannabe came out, Suede's coming up. And it was just so brilliant. And Manic Street Preachers, Everything Must Go.
Three Lines.
Oh,
God.
All the greats. But also, Beck, it's the album that took him from being the sort of one-hit wonder with Loser that always gets played in the indie disco and you're I should like it, but I don't.
Just after Creep by...
Yeah, and you've got to have your head down and your fringes swinging. And this took him to disco, and it just everything about it is so beautiful, and I still love it and still play it today.
Yeah, to me, this is the record that kind of breaks us out of what Britpop was very quickly solidifying into. You know, it's great when it's Paul, but it's Blair and early Oasis, but by the time it's congealed into, you know, the Seahorses and
later Oasis,
and then this arrives, and it is just a world of possibilities. It's kind of spectacularly vivid and crazy and weird.
Yeah,
although there's all that kind of DJ shadowy Beastie Boys stuff, and it reminds me of Money Mark, Push the Button. Do you remember that album?
Push the Button was a fantastic record.
Do you know what? After listening to this, I had to buy that on Amazon because I realised I'd lost it, but it reminded me of that so much.
I thought it was quite interesting because I went back and listened to Paul's Boutique, and it's quite interesting because they obviously made this after Paul's Boutique. It's a lot denser, but it's a lot simpler as well at the same time, you know. And the interesting thing is that the lyrics are actually the lyrics are kind of similar in that they're just throwing images at the wall in the same way as the kind of as the Beastie Boys doing Paul's Boutique, kind of less cultural references, samples longer, more rock kind of country and stuff. The kind of weird thing to me is that he's never continued down that path. This was such a, as you say, it was so different from Loser, and then he kind of went back.
It was the next album was kind of the sort of folky, low-key one, wasn't it?
But then I think when you get to like Sex Laws and Ypres, that harks back to this a little bit more.
Yeah.
And I think it took it on, and it gets a little bit better than this, if that is possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny you say about the lyrics, because I think everyone was like, oh, what a genius, what's he talking about? And I think in an interview he later admitted, like, there's no such thing as sympathy crutches, you know, I was just saying words. And it doesn't matter, because he looked so cool. And
he was great live back then as well.
I was thinking about, and this weekend, it's particularly opposite, Beck was the only act I saw on... the shortest time I ever went to Glastonbury Festival. And I was looking, and it was, I think, 96 or 97. He was touring this.
Mm.
He looked fantastic. He was wearing the kind of cowboy, rhinestone-type cowboy kind of shirt and stuff. He had a full kind of band.
Yeah, he had DJ Swamp, I think it was called. He was kind of doing live scratching.
It was one of the disgusting, wet, horrendous Glastonburys. And I actually remember with my we drove onto the site. We parked the car. We thought, oh, Beck's about to come on. We'll walk down and see Beck, and then we'll go back and get the kind of the camping gear and stuff. We walked down, saw Beck. He was absolutely fantastic. He actually had a bullwhip on stage, I remember, and was doing that kind of snapping the bullwhip around the microphone stand and then pulling it towards him and catching it just as the vocals kind of, just in time for the vocals. It was
like a sort of
absolutely fantastic.
Indie and Indiana Jones.
Yeah,
Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
The rain continued to get heavier and heavier during the set, and actually, partly because my parents at that point lived about 5 miles from the site, we looked at each other at the end of the Beck set and just went, oh, sod it, and walked off and went home.
Wise man.
And just watched the rest of it on a...
They had a kind of, sort of, it was like a soul review type.
It was very much that, yeah. It was very knowing, really, but at the same time, it was really funky.
Like
Outcast,
a bit of that, and Janelle Monáe and stuff, but it was...
Hannah, you were on Smash Hits and Just 17 at this time, is this right?
Yeah, 1996, I'd just started on Just 17, my first year in London.
Amazing. So did Beck make much of an impression on the J17?
Do you know what? He did, because his look, I think, is so important. I was reading reviews from the time of this, and Billboard said he was a snot-nosed slacker with a bad haircut. But he was gorgeous. Yeah. Still is. You know, he had that kind of...
Snake hips.
Yes, yeah, snake hips. Like,
he had a sort of Mark Owen
hair.
Kind of vibe.
Yeah.
He looked kind of quite angelic. And remember there's that episode of The Simpsons where... Lisa Simpson's reading a magazine called Unthreatening Boys.
Yes,
that's Beck.
And that's just 17, and that was Beck. And
he's going to come around and make you a cup of tea.
Had he gone all L. Ron Hubbard on us by this point, or was that?
Yeah, that's the letdown with Beck, isn't it?
That was a later date, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah, Hannah mentioned it a minute ago. The kind of the way he oscillates between effectively the sound of Odelay and the sound of the kind of Love Longo, the acoustic guitar, is what keeps him varied, isn't it? And what keeps him sort of, I think it makes him appeal more widely than just the straight down the line, we're into serious music people.
Yeah, and also I think with people like him, you always get the Lazy Prince comparisons. Anyone who can crack out a falsetto and dance, but he's not Prince, he's Beck. Yeah.
A friend of mine, there's a brilliant cover with the sort of jumping Hungarian sheepdog, and a friend of mine always wanted a Hungarian sheepdog after that, and I finally got one about 10 years ago.
Did you train it?
Absolutely stinks. So it's like, you know, it's like a sort of crusty with sort of dreadlocks. It's got the same kind of smell.
They look like they absolutely stink. Okay, we're nearly running out of time, so we need to get into closing time chatter. This is where we ask our guests to tell us what's been burning a hole in their brain this week, the story or the idea or the argument that they really want to share. Hannah, I believe you have a book.
Yes, I've just read an extract from Miranda Sawyer's Hymn to the Midlife Crisis, Out of Time, and it looks like it will be brilliant. Mm. Some of the things she mentions there have been in your mid-40s and doing the death maths, like, how old will I be at this point? And the whole thing of still trying to be down with the kids or still listening to pop music and thinking, how much longer can this go on? As well as thinking, I'm halfway through my life, I'm going to die soon.
Yeah.
So... I'm really fascinated by it, but the more I start to think about it, the more I thought, are there people in their 80s going, oh, shut up, you're so privileged, you've got no problems.
Yeah, or do you through a war. What's
Or do we get over this? Are we the most spoilt generation?
It's entirely possible. We've got Miranda coming on the show in a couple of weeks' time, so it'll be very interesting. The book is great. It's also quite chilling, isn't it? It's quite sort of, you know, it's very much the sensation of watery grave as you read it.
Yeah, but, I think anyone who's ever been 42 will feel that. And I think also if you're a woman and you've had your children a little bit later, you look at them and you think, hang on a minute, you know, how old are you going to be when I'm got the old stick out? But I think it's something definitely worth looking at, but she's going to help us through it, and I love that.
Oh, God, I remember 42. Those were the days. Michael Hogan, what's your closing
time? You could remember 42?
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to play a short tribute to James Blunty Blunt.
Yes.
Because... I don't know if you've been watching the football this week. There's a new Lotto ad that keeps popping up during the ITV football coverage, with Blunty taking the mickey out of himself. He and the tagline is, anyone can win the lottery, please don't let it be him, because he wants to launch this range of singing your beautiful mirrors based on a technology for. And I just thought, well, you know, Blunty is something of a ledge, he would say. He laughs at himself all the time. He's brilliant on Twitter. He sort of seeks out trolls and haters and then does snappy comes back to them. I don't know if you ever saw him on Sesame Street, where he did a song called My Triangle to the sound to the tune of You're Beautiful. It was brilliant. And I just think Blunty's got a big sense of humour, and
you kind of think
we need
as well,
to reclaim him.
The other people that they've used for that campaign, kind of Noel Edmonds and
Katie Price
stuff.
Yeah.
I kind of feel that Blunt's got a much more self-awareness than them, who are just thinking, you know, they haven't even considered the whole kind of ramifications of being
But he just also doesn't need to do it, as they probably do, don't they? And he's got a nightclub in his garden in Ibiza called Blunties, where and the tagline is, where everybody is beautiful.
Oh, I really want to go. I really want to go to Blunties.
And it's got a kind of waxwork sort of door person holding a clipboard, and he writes your name on it when you go in.
He's one of those. It's not very often when you find somebody you really don't like their music very much. I don't think Blunty's music is for me, but I really like him.
Yeah.
He seems like a really good player. But of course, having served in Bosnia, he's a you know, proper serving soldier.
Yeah.
Nothing is going to freak him out. You know, this is the guy who's been shot at.
Perspective, mate.
Yeah, perspective. This is the guy who literally prevented World War III by his actions in Bosnia. Okay, well, my closing time chatter is I've become obsessed with Mary Beard's book, SPQR, Her History of Rome, not least because it contains an actual joke from Roman times based in real events, the general Lucius Mummius Achaicus conquered the Peloponnese and brought all the priceless booty back home. He had a reputation as a bit of a philistine, and he told his legionaries, if any of these priceless antiquities are damaged in transit, you've got to buy a new one. So I thought that was quite good going, you know, to have bad jokes reaching across history.
Roman ruffles.
Roman ruffles, absolutely, yes.
Can I just make a special shout out to the bloke who's putting up on Vine or video on Instagram the football lineups at the start of the Euro 2016 matches, when all the players are lined up and they go down while they're playing the national anthem. The person who's going through that and putting dog's faces on the players from Snapchat is absolute a genius. It makes everything so much better.
Fantastic. Okay, well, that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you so much to our guests, Hannah Verdier and Michael Hogan. Thank you for coming. Remember, you can hear this show again, and in fact, all of our past shows, on audioboom.com. Go there and search for Big Mouth. You can listen live, and you can also download from there. Follow us at facebook.com/BigMouthUK for more podcasts and more interesting stuff to read. And if you want to subscribe via iTunes, just go to the podcast section of the iTunes Music Store, search for Big Mouth and subscribe. And also, if you get a minute, give us a rating, give us a star rating or a little review. It helps get us up the charts. We'll be back next week with more quality blather about pop culture. In the meantime, have a splendid week and goodbye.